What's Next from American Security Project, I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by David Pollack, the Kaufman Fellow at the Washington Institute, where he focuses on the political dynamics of Middle East countries, that's a lot of countries, and is the director of Project FICRA, which focuses on research, publication, and network building designed to generate policy ideas for promoting positive change and countering the spread of extremism in the Middle East. David, thanks for joining us.
Sure, happy to be here.
So, while we've had a lot of episodes of What's Next, and many people talk about the Middle East, you are actually our first bona fide Middle East expert, so welcome.
Well, thanks again.
Okay. And we've had a lot of questions about the Middle East.
I'm sure.
It's an enormous region.
Right.
And so when you hear someone say the Middle East, what qualifies as the Middle East for you?
Okay, that's a great question to start. I would say that as a common sense answer, the Middle East includes all of the Arab countries, plus Israel and Iran and Turkey. And some people would extend that a little bit further east to add what many people, I think, correctly call South Asia, which is Afghanistan and Pakistan. But as mainly Muslim countries right on the edge of the Middle East, they are part of the equation in many ways. And these days, I have to say, although it's not part of the Middle East, that what we're seeing is a resurgence of Russian intervention and influence in the region. So you have to say that the Middle East is kind of right at the center of a lot of the issues all around the globe, not just because of the issue of terrorism or the issue of instability and religious conflict. But I think oil is also still something, even though we Americans are no longer dependent on Middle East oil, the rest of the world still is. So I would venture to say that the Middle East is one of the key regions of the world, however you define it.
And do you think that by defining the Middle East as we have, as kind of this amorphous blob that includes parts of Southeast Asia, by in some ways ignoring the countries in that we now refer to as the Middle East that are actually Southeast Asian, by ignoring the fact that they are in fact Southeast Asian, we lose something in our policy and how we think about those countries? Does it make sense to in some ways erase that part?
I would say that it's a fuzzy issue, honestly. And these countries of Afghanistan and Pakistan, in particular, South Asia, are part of the region, and ignoring them or putting them in a separate category was one of the, I'm sorry to have to say, in retrospect, 15 years later, was one of the reasons why people missed some of the warning signs leading up to 9/11.
Interesting.
But today, it's still true that although there are connections between, for example, Afghanistan and Pakistan and jihadi violence and extremism in the Middle East and elsewhere in the world, and Al-Qaeda is still an issue.
We tend to forget that.
Right. and that's where it's coming from,
right,
primarily, although it's metastasized to other countries. I think there is a useful distinction that you can still make. And what's happened in American policy specifically is that we have become very deeply entangled in wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and now in military activity in many places around the region, drones and special forces and so on. Not a full-fledged land campaign, but serious military hostilities. So that has tended to bring these countries in a strange way together in American consciousness and I think in reality. The fact that the United States is engaged militarily in Afghanistan and in Iraq and has been for the last 15 years to some extent, I think means that the Middle East is actually sort of spreading. And it's a bigger region than we used to think about it as just the narrow core of the Arab-Israeli conflict, for example.
Now, you've mentioned al-Qaeda, and we kind of made a little offhand comment that al-Qaeda is still alive and well.
Yep.
And in some people's minds, we've forgotten about them.
Right.
And they're very different from IS or ISIL or ISIS, whatever
yep.
name you'd like to call mm-hmm. them, Daesh. How do you see those differences?
The main difference is that al-Qaeda was set up as a hierarchical organization
mm-hmm.
with a central command based in Afghanistan and also in Pakistan, I have to say, to be honest, and with cells in other places. But as much as they could, in a practical sense, directed by a headquarters
sure.
and by a top leadership. And I think to a great extent, that remains the case even today.
Mm-hmm.
The Daesh, or ISIS, ISIL, the Islamic State, as they call
Take
themselves,
your pick, yeah.
right, is different in that it's deliberately spread out and cultivates this ethos of lone wolves
mm-hmm.
who are inspired by, if not actually organized or directed by, the ideas of the caliphate, as they call it. And so it's a much more diffuse movement. It's more oriented toward youth mobilization
mm-hmm.
on social media and less toward some kind of central, clear-cut, organized violence. But that probably makes it more dangerous, not less dangerous. And what we're seeing right now is, I have to say, a kind of a contest between the two.
Right.
But it, you know, there are no good guys here, right?
Right.
It's not that al-Qaeda is better or worse or ISIS is better or worse. They're both pretty terrible.
Right. And do you think our current policies, both, you know, diplomatic, so soft power and hard power,
right.
do you think all of our policies are better suited towards dealing with one than the other, and therefore making one, in some ways, obviously neither of them are favorable,
right.
but something we're better equipped to take down?
Look, that's a really good question. It doesn't have a really simple answer.
It never
like,
does.
Like most good questions. I think, honestly, our soft power, that is to say the power of our ideas, our communications, our example, our cultural influence, all of that is not well suited to confronting either one of these terrorist organizations. Because, for the very simple reason that this is an internal Islamic battle.
Right. It really has, in some ways, nothing to do with
right.
us.
Right. And we're just not credible
right.
as a source of ideas or information
right.
in that context. So the really epic battle between relatively moderate or enlightened Islam and this perverted, violent version of it is something that we can't fight. That's something that Muslims have to fight for themselves.
Hmm.
And when it comes to hard power, we are quite well suited to confronting either al-Qaeda or ISIS to the extent that they have a target for
right.
us. In other words, when al-Qaeda and the Taliban were in control of Afghanistan around the time of 9/11, we went after them and we demolished their military and physical control right. of the country in a matter of months. And that's what we're doing right now with right. ISIS in Mosul in Iraq, and I think pretty soon in Raqqa in Syria. Mm-hmm. And we can do that. And we can do that actually quickly
well.
and well, and with very few losses on our side.
Right.
Working with local allies right. in both cases.
Yes.
And that's fine, but and it's necessary, I think. But it doesn't eliminate the threat, because these groups can go underground.
Mm-hmm.
The Taliban are still very much around
yep.
15 years later. Al-Qaeda is still very much around 15 years later. And I'm afraid that that's likely to be the case with the Islamic State or Daesh or ISIS as well.
So what would successfully eliminate, or if not eliminate, marginalize to what we might call an acceptable capacity?
Right.
If anything, you know, is there a policy out there? Is it something that the U.S. has any role in doing?
Yeah, I think so. I think, first of all, when it comes to the terrorist threat per se, we've actually been really quite successful. And although there have been some sensational terrorist incidents here at home in recent years, there hasn't been
right.
a major terrorist attack like 9/11 for the better part
right.
of a decade and a half.
Right.
And so our defenses against that have been successful, whether we're talking about airline safety procedures, which I can tell you from my own
very
recent experience
yeah.
are a huge pain in the neck, but
yeah.
I'm afraid are the price of doing business these
right.
days. And to intelligence and surveillance and undercover and even sting operations that are aimed at reducing the terrorist threat. We're good at that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are always going to be, tragically, exceptions
right.
that prove the rule. But compared to many other countries in the world, especially compared to Europe in the last few years,
right.
we've got a good track record, and I think that's likely to continue. And partly that's because our own Muslim American population is
absolutely.
Very well integrated into society.
Right.
And that's a big help. But at the same time, I think on the level of ideas and ideologies,
mm-hmm.
as I said before, this is probably something that the American government is, frankly, incapable.
Right. Doesn't even though our current attempts are not very good, it doesn't really matter how good they are if they're coming from us.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Now,
yeah.
there is a potentially better, bigger, more effective
okay.
role, not for the U.S. government, but for Americans as people and for American society and for American religious communities and organizations, NGOs, non-government organizations.
Mm-hmm.
There is a role, I think, limited, but probably better than the U.S. government role in affecting the perception of the United States, the perception of the so-called clash of civilizations between
right.
Western and Middle Eastern or Islamic cultures and people. If I think there is a useful role, for example, for interfaith dialogue here in the United States and between Americans and people of faith in the Middle East and in the broader Middle East as a way of helping to bridge the gap and reducing the friction and the tension. This is not something, as I said, that the government
right.
is particularly well suited to do, but it is something that goes on every day in quiet ways and I think has some positive effect. It's not going to eliminate the right. issue, but it is going to, as you said, I think, help reduce it to manageable proportions.
Right, or at least, you know, manageable proportions for us, for the United
right.
States.
Yes, that's a really good point that you're making, because the reality is that this is much more of a problem inside these Muslim or predominantly Muslim societies than it is here. Most of the victims of jihadi terrorism of any kind, whether it's Al-Qaeda or ISIS, you name it, are actually the people who live right there,
right.
Muslims.
So there's something that an ASP board member repeats quite often, and that, and I'm hoping that this is in fact still true, I'm fairly certain it is, that in the United States you are more likely to be killed by a falling tree branch than you are an act of terror. I keep an eye on this stat because it's a good anecdote in some ways. And so when you have that in mind, right, that our risk is relatively low.
Yes.
At the same time, we have a society that is in some ways hyper-focused.
Yes.
On extremism, violent extremism in the Middle East and in North Africa, but primarily in the Middle East. And this deep concern about something happening to, quote, us,
yes.
right? And yet, in some people's minds, maybe and doesn't match up with concern about the people who it's actually impacting, the people who are at risk
sure.
of death by a terrorist attack greater than a falling tree branch.
Right.
And do you think that matters, or it doesn't really matter why we want to deal with this problem? Or does it matter, and does it impact how we deal with it, maybe?
Yeah, it does. I do think that the concern about it is a bit exaggerated, it just measured in objective mm-hmm. terms of casualties and the concern about jihadi terrorism here inside the United States. Yes, it's blown out of proportion. But it's understandable that that would be the case, because that's in the nature, in human nature,
right.
I guess. People are more worried about deliberate acts of violence than they are about accidents.
Right.
Whether of nature or car crashes or falling tree branches or
whatever.
And that's actually the whole idea of terrorism, is to create panic
right.
and to create tension and to create distrust and exploit these social cleavages or religious conflicts for political purposes. And the way to do that is, tragically, to make it actually random and sensational and somehow drag the media into it to amplify the effect, and it works. And that's what we see in
right.
terms of all the polling data about popular concern about terrorism or about Islamic radicalism.
Or
here
Muslims
in, the United
in
States.
General, regardless of if they're
yeah. Now, right. You read my mind.
I
mean, that's going to, I would say, a radical extreme of
right.
its own kind,
right.
which is to blame a whole community of.
That's worked out well historically.
Population.
We found is that something that we should continue doing? I'm not
I think,
sure.
That's exactly what the terrorists want.
Right.
They want people in the United States or in Europe to turn against Muslims and to create a situation in which whole communities of people are pitted against each other for no good reason. And so if we want to fight terrorism, one of the first things to do is to make sure we don't fall into that trap. But I want to say also that although the concern about victims of terrorism here in the United States is disproportionate compared to the objective statistics, it's not disproportionate looking at our friends in the Muslim world.
Absolutely.
And in the Middle East, whether Muslims or non-Muslims, because we have allies and partners in the region.
And human beings.
That's right. And that's exactly right. And from a humanitarian, but also I think from a standpoint of cold-hearted strategic interests, those friends and those people and those interests are threatened in a serious way by jihadi terrorism. And so what we are trying to do, and I think what we are going to need to continue to do, is to work with them to confront that common enemy.
So, pivoting a little bit, but not too much.
Not too much, okay.
not to throw anyone's brain completely out of whack. We're talking about, you know, what the goals of jihadi organizations and movements are, and driving people apart, especially when one group or community is in a time of great need. And we look at the Middle East, and there is great need.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we are involved militarily in certain ways. We don't necessarily have, as you said, a large land campaign led involving U.S. troops, however, drones, special forces, advisors, et cetera. There were many questions when the battle for Mosul began.
Okay.
Regarding why did the plans include an opening, right? Why was there a physical opening?
Okay.
Why did we not envelop?
To let civilians out?
That's it. Yeah. So why would we do that? Why would we not just envelop the city? And it, the answer, exactly as you said, had to do with civilians.
Yeah.
So this is not a situation where everybody on the ground is a combatant, right?
Absolutely.
There are millions of civilians in the crosshairs.
Right, that's right.
What do we do about that?
Yeah, it's a dilemma. And I think there's no perfect answer, but I think that trying as best we and our partners on the ground can to, first of all, avoid inflicting civilian casualties ourselves, and secondly, ensuring, again, as best we can, it's not going to be perfect, that civilians have an escape route and access to humanitarian relief once they do escape. All of those things are actually both in our interest and in accordance with our values. And by trying to protect civilians, whether Muslims in the crossfire, caught in the crossfire, through no fault of their own, as you said, or minorities, and there are many.
Christians,
and,
Yazidi,
yes,
Kurds,
that's right.
The four Jews left in many of these countries.
There are many of them in Iraq and in Syria and in Afghanistan and Pakistan and other places who are likely to be singled out for persecution or even extermination by the truly radical forces in those regions. In trying to protect those people is important for our own sake, for our values, and also, as I say, I think for our interests, because it helps make us more credible as partners in this battle and with the moderate forces, whether Muslim or non-Muslim. And that's something that the battle for Mosul is illustrating right now as we speak. I would just add two other quick points about that. One is that I've heard some people say that in this election season that we're in right now, that by allowing an escape route and by telegraphing our punches, right, by announcing that we're going to start the battle for Mosul, that we have allowed ISIS leaders to escape, and that that was some kind of terrible tactical error. I think it's exactly the reverse. We want those people. We want the leaders, if we can't kill them outright. We want them to
on
run
the
away.
Run.
We
yeah.
want them to run away so that they can't direct the battle. And so that their followers will see that they've been abandoned
right.
by their own so-called leaders of these terrorist
exactly.
Islamist organizations like ISIS. And we want to be able to catch them on the run
right.
or in the next place that
it's
they try
to find
sanctuary.
It's much easier to catch someone in an open desert than it is in a city.
Yeah, or if they end up in Raqqa, that's
right.
okay, because
right.
we're going after Raqqa next,
yeah.
and we'll get them sooner or later. And meanwhile, they will have left their foot soldiers behind.
Absolutely.
And much less capable of holding their ground in Mosul or some other place. So that's number one.
Mm-hmm.
And number two is, I think when we fight these battles, that it's not the immediate humanitarian issues
nice.
That are going to matter.
Absolutely.
What's also going to matter greatly is how to put the pieces back
absolutely.
Together after the fight. And that's very, very, very
it's
complicated.
It's sort of doesn't matter what happens in the moment. It's the
right.
long term.
And here I'm talking, when we say long term, we're really just talking about
Six
a matter
months.
Of weeks
right.
or months. And,
right.
What you're going to have after ISIS is kicked out of Mosul, which I think will happen pretty soon, is the potential for further conflict among different religious communities, Sunnis and Shiites, and between ethnic groups like Arabs and Kurds, or between and Turkmen, and between rival neighboring
yeah.
countries like Turkey or Iran,
hmm.
and this is not primarily our battle, but it's one that the local parties are going to have to figure
sure.
out. But I think we can help them,
be a neutral
at least
broker.
On the margins, avoid the worst mistakes of the past and create a better, more consensual, more peaceful future. And that's what they want, too, most
right.
of them, I think.
Right. They do have to live there.
That's right. Yeah.
So our last question is always, what's next? And I'm going to pose it to you kind of in a confined framework.
Okay.
So several months ago now, you spoke at ASP's
yep.
Event on the Syrian refugee crisis.
Right.
And one of the debates that came up there that comes up, I think, for many people involved on this on a daily basis, if not an hourly basis, is, okay, you have this enormous existing immediate humanitarian need
right.
balanced against this desire to prevent Somalia from happening again in Syria, right, from creating a power vacuum from you've removed everybody,
uh-huh.
And so what is left? So weighing both of those, right, the short-term need to
yeah.
provide safety, humanitarian assistance, et cetera, for people, and what happens 6 months, a year, 5 years, 10
okay.
years down the line,
right. Yeah.
How do we figure out what to do next?
Yeah, well, I would say a few quick things. One is that our first priority, I think, properly,
mm-hmm.
is to protect our own citizens and our own security, our own interests. And that's our first priority.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if we admit larger numbers of Syrian or other refugees into the United States, it is important to make sure that we protect our own security by weeding out potential threats among that population. There, it's a very, very tiny proportion.
Right, and do you think our current systems do a good job of doing that, or could
yes,
they be
I do.
Better?
I think the evidence is very clear on that score.
Mm-hmm.
The people, the very tiny handful
right.
of immigrants who have, I mean, I'm talking really about counting on the fingers
right.
of one hand,
right.
who have joined terrorist organizations here in this country
right.
committed acts of violence
right.
on their behalf. These are not among the refugees.
Right.
These are people who, in many cases,
have
been here.
Here
for decades.
Right.
And unfortunately. But that's a tiny, tiny number of people. And the refugee population are mostly entirely innocent civilians just right. caught in the crossfire and in desperate need of help. But we need to, nevertheless, I think, be properly cautious and vigilant about protecting our own security, first and foremost. At the same time, in accordance with our values, I think it's as Americans who have always been a beacon of hope for refugees from all over the world for centuries. Most of us here are the children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren of refugees from someplace.
Right.
And I'm reminded, actually, of what I think was just a fantastic quote from Franklin Roosevelt addressing the daughters of the American Revolution. Sometime, I think, in the early 1940s. And that was an organization that at the time stood for a kind of nativism, right?
Right.
Anti-immigrants, a kind of xenophobic attitude of, well, we got here first, so we're better
really
than
second,
you are,
but we'll pretend
and we're
going
to keep you out.
Yeah.
And Franklin Roosevelt, much to his credit, addressed a convention of the DAR, Daughters of the American
right.
Revolution, and he started out, went up to the microphone and started out his speech saying, "Fellow immigrants." And it was a brilliant and I think moving and telling example.
I didn't know that.
Of, yeah, that's right.
That's very interesting.
It's beautiful.
Yeah,
and
it is.
It's exactly where we are today. So in accordance with that great American tradition and our values, I think it is important for the United States to continue to be, as the Statue of Liberty would have it, a beacon of hope for immigrants and refugees from around the world. And today, that means, because that's where most of the refugees are coming
right.
from, that means a special focus on the Middle East and also on Africa. And so that's part of who we are, and that's part of what makes us Americans and what makes us an example.
Are you trying to say what makes
world.
Us great?
Well, we are great.
We are great.
But
exactly how we
what
are.
What I'm trying to say is it's what has built up our country.
Absolutely.
And it's not that we're not doing this only as a favor
right.
to other people. We're doing this because
that's what you
this
do.
Is what we're justly proud of, and this is what has built up our country from almost nothing 200 years ago to the greatest country in the world still today.
Well, David Pollack from the Washington Institute, thank you for joining us. We will absolutely have you back.
My great pleasure and honor. Thank you.
This has been What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Milch.